To me, the X-Men became about, it was actually about adults versus children. Because I felt that the whole thrust of the X-Men was actually about the generational thing, that people dislike their children because new ways of looking at things, and adults kind of don't like that because it's threatening to them. So I saw the X-Men as being about that, and basically that's where we took it in that direction. Basically about the war between adults and youth.
But I don't know if don't look at me.
I'm looking at you.
You got yourself into that.
I'm looking at you for validation, Stan. It's all I want.
Welcome to E for Evolution, examining Grant Morrison's X-Men. I am one of your hosts, Perry Constantine.
This is Pat.
And hi, it's Oscar.
How are you guys doing today?
I'm good. Oscar. I'm good. It's very cold here in Sydney. Well, it's cold for Sydney at the moment, but I've got the heater on, so I'm nice and warm.
Yeah, not bad. Took the day off work, so caught up with some comic reading and house cleaning. It's always such a fun combo.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got a backlog of like a few hundred books on Comixology because they always have those sales, so I'm still working my way through those. I think the last thing I bought was like the Complete Exiles run. They had a sale on like last month, I think.
I will not be shamed by my backlog collection. It's fine. Fine.
Okay.
I have a really big backlog collection. I just smash through it as soon as I get it. I can't hold on.
Well, because with me, it's the sales. So, like, they have, like, you know, these big sales. Like, it's, you know, and they're almost always graphic novels. So, it's like, you know, X-Men sale. And it's like, they're all like $2 or $3 a pop. And so I just, you know, click, 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 click. And the next thing I know, I've got like 10 books. And the pile just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. All right. So today we're talking about New X-Men 115, which is E is for Extinction Part 2 of 3, written by Grant Morrison, of course, drawn by Frank Quitely. Tim Townsend and Mark Morales did the inks. The colors are by Hi-Fi Design and Richard Starkings Comic Craft and Saida for letters. Pete Franco is the assistant editor, Mark Power is the editor, and then, of course, Joe Quesada, editor-in-chief, and Bill Gemmis, president of Marvel. So this was the, after the, you know, the big shocking, the big, not really shocking, like the big shift in everything in 114. This is the second part, and this was during a time when the, not only Marvel, but a lot of comic books, they were doing the short story arc thing. So it's like, you know, these three-part stories or something like that. And sometimes it felt kind of, you know, the whole decompression thing. But there's a lot that happens in this issue, I felt, going back and rereading it. What did you guys think? Let's see what you guys, what your impressions were overall of this issue. Pat?
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a lot of plot that happened. I really enjoyed how Quitely and Morrison like play with scale in this issue. Like, so you know that opening page that you have up on the screen where you have Cassandra and Trask sort of, I think they're on the other side of the mother mold now. It's like this sort of interesting way in which he plays with scale. Which gets reversed at the end of the issue, which we'll get to in a little bit. But I really like how they're sort of playing and skewering with scale and perspective in the issue.
Oscar, how about you?
Well, I agree with everything that you say, that going back through and rereading it, so much happens in this one issue. You know, just like a brief overview, you've got the introduction of Emma Frost as a proper X-Man, the death of Magneto, the destruction of Genosha, Cassandra Nova fully realized as a powerful villain, and then the takeover of Professor Xavier. That's 5 or 6 really huge things. Mm-hmm. I think today with the decompression, if that many things happened in one arc, it would take 12 issues. But this just smashes it all into one, and it doesn't feel like it's rushed. It just feels big. And it's a huge, going back and rereading it, I realized exactly how big it actually was.
Yeah, and this issue, I think, is probably the most significant change that Morrison introduced that became long lasting, right? And that's the destruction of Genosha. And and if I'm not mistaken, I think this issue was at the very least written and drawn before 9/11. Right, but it was in 2001, so it was so eerie to you know, rereading this issue and seeing the destruction of Genosha and the destruction of Magda Square, which is very similar to, which is obviously modeled after Times Square, and just like the image of the Sentinel, which has been, you know, co-opted into like a plane type of configuration, crashing into Magneto's Citadel. And then seeing that happen in real life with the Twin Towers, and just rereading this issue and being like, oh my God, I forgot that this issue came before that.
And I was actually thinking the exact same thing as I was rereading it. Having the image of 9/11 come through and this coming out just before that was almost Nostradamus-like. Mm-hmm. The imagery is pretty spot on. The fact that Magda Square, as you said, is based, it looks like Times Square. Even the way the plane hits the building that Magneto's in is reminiscent of the Twin Towers. The one thing that I got when I re-looked at it that I didn't pick up the first couple of times that I read it back in the early 2000s was that the plane actually looks like a fist.
You know, I was about to say that. Like,
oh, that's good.
I never realized that before.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe it's possible maybe Comixology or Marvel remastered the page, but yeah, like I'm seeing that it looks, see, it's amazing how it's 20 years later and we're still.
Yeah, I see. You're right. It looks exact. I didn't pick up on that before, but it does look exactly like this.
And I was going to say, Oscar, like all those events that you mentioned occurred in like, I think, 4 pages of story. So like it's like hit after hit after hit and like such a small compressed amount of space.
Right. But it doesn't feel compressed. Like that's the thing. It's like, it feels sudden, and which is exactly how this kind of
thing happens. Should be.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. You've got this page. We've got this opening in Genosha with Emma talking to her class, and then you know we have Negasonic Teenage Warhead, who you know another character who ended up getting used in the movies, and where they just basically kept her name and they changed everything else about her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's like some subtle, like I guess homages to the source, but yeah, I mean,
yeah, but it was a funny thing because when they were looking for a character for that role, they found that name and they're just like, oh, we've got to use that name.
Sold.
And I love that character in the movies too, so I really love what they did with her. And it's so funny how they took like this little throwaway thing that Morrison just tossed in there and then turned her into this really awesome character in the movies.
Speaking of new things, I was going to read my hard copy, but now I'm glad I'm reading it digitally because I think there was some kind of remastering or something that happened. And I really am noticing things that I didn't realize was there before. Like, you know, when Cassandra is giving Trask this tour inside the Sentinel, like some of these Sentinels' heads are like made of tanks. Like there's a tank in the scent, which I just did not notice before. I think it's on page, I want to say 38 of the trade.
Let's see. Oh, is it this page here?
No, it's later on. Like if you have the collected edition on Comixology, it is page 38.
Here we go.
Yeah, like on the left hand side, not that people can see, but you know, that sort of that middle panel. But there's like, there's a tank sitting in its head. That is its head.
Oh yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is where we get a real, we delve a little bit deeper into the, well, I just love this interaction between Cyclops and Wolverine. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, Morrison is just really good with this dialogue. And also quite Lizard here, right? Because it's this very subtle thing that I realized last night, which you probably don't notice unless you're reading it in, one of the nice things about Comixology is it has the guided view, so it zooms in on the panels. Mm-hmm. And I never realized it before, but Wolverine's eyes looking off to the side when he says, did something just hit us?
Mm.
Right? Just again, just like this little subtle thing that quietly does with his art.
When I was rereading it, especially this panel that you're speaking about now with Ugly John, it really struck me with the art how different all of the men's faces are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how little we see that now. Mm. In comics, you know, it's maybe because the turnover rate is so fast that the artists have to spit out so many issues. They don't have as much time to detail it.
But yeah, that's been something
so different from Wolverine.
Yeah, that's been something that's been a problem with it's not even a new problem. It's been there for a while. Like you look at John Byrne's art, like his faces there's not a lot of differentiation in his faces. But there are a few artists who stand out. Quietly is one of them. George Perez is another one who does a very good job of differentiating his characters. Mm-hmm. You know, Alex Ross, of course, obviously, but you know, these are these artists who take a lot of time. And you know, talking about Quietly's art and comparing it to last issue, because remember last episode we were talking that his faces don't kind of look right in that first issue, but in this one, it feels like his art took a big jump forward.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. I agree with that completely. And I didn't realize how quickly the art improved. But my main issue with the art my main problem with the art previously was the women's faces.
Mm-hmm.
And that just seems to improve dramatically in this issue. It's like he fixed whatever it was that was causing the problem before. Not completely, but mm-hmm. definitely a massive improvement.
Yeah. And again, this feel of motion, like with the Sentinels climbing all over the X-Wing here, that's, again, like just the kinetic energy he's able to put in these panels is, as someone who's, you know, starting to become an artist myself, I just love the detail he's able to do in that. And just like, it's amazing how he's able to do this so effortlessly.
Mm-hmm.
When this first came out, they were saying it was widescreen comics.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that the art was almost cinematography. And I think especially in that page that you've got up now where the plane is going to crash, you're reading from left to right.
Mm-hmm.
And every single panel, the plane is slowly going from left to right and dropping as the page drops as well as your eyes go from the top to the bottom of the page. Mm-hmm. It does help to give that sense of movement that the plane is actually falling.
Mm-hmm.
It's a gift. He's a really good artist in terms of the sense of movement.
Yeah. And Patrick, I saw you mentioned this in the notes, but Scott's line here about insurance takes care of anything. Like, I just love he is, and this kind of, this is kind of a callback to what Wolverine said in the last issue. I love your mm-hmm. icy cool lunacy under pressure. And mm-hmm. this is what he's doing here, right? He's just like,
right.
You know, engine 3 is out and he's just saying it so matter-of-factly.
Mm-hmm. I also liked it for like how it kind of peels the curtain back a little bit with mm-hmm. like how does the X-Men work? How do they afford all this stuff? How does Charles get a plane? And
mm-hmm.
well, obviously and logically, he insures everything given right. the high rate of turnover on this stuff.
And I think I forgot to mention this last episode, but the detail here on the Sentinel Master Mold, like, I love the, my daughter's over here in her playpen next to me, so
yeah.
She's chiming in a little bit. But I just love the detail he puts in on the Master Mold, right? The texturing he does in here is really well done. And mm-hmm. it's got this feel of both being technological, but also kind of, you know, overtaken by nature at the same time.
Yeah, like it blends in with the environment.
Yeah.
Which goes with sort of the very like, it's this life-giving deity mm-hmm. type vibe aesthetic that he gives it, right? Because I mean, it's creating all of these new life forms around it.
Right, right. And I love this panel here when Cyclops is ejecting from the X-Wing and it blows up. Like just that, that's such a good, the colorist did an amazing job on this panel, especially, I think. Like just that image of like the silhouetted Scott with the yellow of the uniform and the red of his visor being the only things that are shining through.
The colorists do a really good job. And I don't know if it's, I haven't fished through to find the original paper copies anymore. I've just been reading the digital ones. But even the one change that I feel is kept through that started with this arc in particular is the red tinge when they're in the cockpit of mm-hmm. the plane.
Mm-hmm.
I think any X-Men comic book you read now, if they're sitting in chairs or even standing and talking and there's a red tinge above it, you know that they're in the Blackbird.
Right. And
what did you guys think about this scene where they're getting chased by the insect wild sentinels and John gets his knee blown off? Because I remember feeling that was especially gruesome, and it was gruesome in a way that I wasn't used to seeing in an X-Men comic.
Yeah, it's really visceral. Interesting. Yeah, it is very visceral, and it also kind of drives home this notion that the X-Men are, that you've got these two group that the X-Men are trained specialists. It's not just too often. I think that when we think about the X-Men, it's kind of like this idea where you have mutant powers, now you can be a superhero. But this, and I think that's kind of the purpose Ugly John serves in these two issues, is to kind of show that no, mutants are just like any other civilian who'd be thrown in the middle of a war zone. You'd have soldiers and you'd have civilians. And I think this is a very quick way to kind of illustrate that.
I mentioned the scale thing before, and I really enjoyed, I mean, Logan and Scott are not having a fun time, but I was having a fun time. Sort of this almost like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids type of effect happening. So like they're fighting these robotic insects that are bigger than they are. And I really appreciate that sort of kind of perverse reversal there. And I like how lo-fi these sentinels are. Like it's not lasers, it's not that, like it's bullets, which kind of feeds into that visceral element that Oscar mentioned.
Yeah, it feels more, the fights feel a little bit more personal that way,
I think. Mm-hmm. And like more I don't know if emotive is the right word, like there's just something kind of like like it's hard, I think, for folks to maybe relate to, like, how would being hit by a laser feel like? But I feel like, having the threat be bullets or some kind of projectile being thrown at you gives more of a, like, pulls the reader in better.
It grounds it a little bit more, mm-hmm. which is something Oscar mentioned a lot about this run in the last episode, I believe.
And I was going to mention again when you guys brought up the insurance pays for everything. That's another really cheeky way to ground things as well, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. And it's also, it's something, it reminds me of a line Morrison said once when he was talking about, he was saying something about Batman, and he says, adults are always asking stupid questions about how things happen in these stories. And it's like, like who rotates the tires on the Batmobile? And he's like, nobody rotates the tires. It just gets done.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, and a kid understands that, right? So I think he throws in this line like about insurance. I think that's kind of like a way to just say, like, look, that's how it is. It's insurance takes care of everything. Now shut up and move on.
Mm-hmm.
And I love this panel too of Cyclops's visor shattering, right? And just like this kind of feel like the way the glass, like just the ruby quartz just like hovers there as his eye beams come out. I feel like this is like, if we were watching this in a movie, this would be an image happening in slow motion.
Yeah, that's a very Zack Snyderian feel to it that oh, panel God,
don't
does.
That, don't use that name around me.
I'm sorry. Sorry. One and only time.
And also this panel of Wolverine just slicing through the Sentinel. And I do love, again, just like with the last issue, the way that quietly, very quickly in his art, he showcases their two different fighting styles very well. Like Wolverine is just this, you know, up close berserker, and Scott is just very calm and shooting things from a distance. Like even when he's getting blown away, he seems almost zen about it.
He is very still, right? He is very still in comparison with the shots of Wolverine, where he seems full of energy and a real brawler.
Yeah.
But Cyclops is, you know, even his laser beam is straight.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of that sort of head that helps with that as well, I think.
Absolutely. And this is something too, when we get back to the mansion, we have Beast trying to compose a letter to Trish Tilby. Right? This is another example of these little nods to continuity that Morrison throws in. And if this is your first time ever reading an X-Men comic, all you do here is you see, oh, he's having trouble with his girlfriend. Right. You just get that very instantly. But if you've been a reader since the 80s, you're like, oh, yeah, that was his girlfriend from X-Factor. And they broke up and they got back together. And you the whole history of these characters is playing out in your head. So it's this nice little Easter egg that he throws in there.
What do you guys think of the interaction with Jean and Professor X here?
I love this interaction. For starters, I do love another thing that jumped out to me is the way that her telekinesis is working in the background to prepare the washcloth.
It's almost like subconsciously,
exactly.
Right?
It's
subconsciously happening. It's something she's even not making a big deal of. But I also think it's good, the way that you mentioned Cyclops and Wolverine's fighting styles show their personality, and it's the dichotomy of the two is especially present in that fight with the wild sentinels there. This scene with Jean and Professor X, I think, shows her, she's always been presented as like nurturing and warm and almost, I wouldn't say mothering, but she's always the maternal one of the group.
Right.
And her dousing his head down with the cloth and sort of telling him to sit back and gently probing him is showing her her Jean personality just in the same way as the two men fighting have.
Right. Something else I love about this is that Jean's the only one who can call Charles on his shit. Right.
Yeah.
And it's because she's known him for so long. Like, you know, with Scott, with Hank, with any of the other original X-Men even, they haven't known Jean as long. Jean goes back to Xavier from when she was a child. So that's how long she's known him. And they've always had kind of a different relationship. And so whereas the other ones, he's always been like, you know, this teacher kind of thing. And there's always this authority sense, especially with Scott and the whole surrogate father thing. But with Jean, right, she's like, you know what, I knew you back when. So, and she's able to call him on his shit. She's like, you know, why didn't you tell us that you had a gun? And when he tries to wave it off and says, like, you know, get me my chair. And she says, you know, I'm not Scott, you know, so cut the bullshit. I just love that about her.
Yeah. Do you think a big part of that is the fact that she's telepathic as well? Mm-hmm. So they can communicate on a deeper level anyway.
Yeah. I think like that lends itself to some notion of exactly that. Like there's less bullshit, I would say, between two psychics, right? Because there's nowhere to hide that stuff.
Right, right. And it's a nice contrast when Hank comes in and then, you know, he tells Henry, you know, he's like, you know, my chair, please, Henry. And you know, Beast is going to bring the chair over. So it shows that nice contrast in how she's separate from the other X-Men in this way. And I do love his rationale here about this, right? About how, you know, my brain is a lethal weapon and I have to have contingencies in case someone takes control of it, which again is a callback to other stuff that's happened, like we mentioned in the last episode, like Onslaught and the Shadow King, mm-hmm. and all that kind of thing.
I thought it was a little bit of a commentary on American gun culture as well.
Oh, okay.
I saw like it was just touching on that. That's what I read into it, just a little bit, just very gently sort of mentioning it. Because why do you need a gun? Why do they need a gun?
Yeah, that's a good point. And it is, you're right. I didn't quite pick up on that, especially because, you know, they comment a lot on this in Morrison's run, especially. There's a lot of commentary about liberal hypocrisy. Like, you know, that, and I think that's kind of another example of that kind of thing with Xavier, you know, preaching tolerance and nonviolence, but he's got this, which is always
packing.
Yeah, he's packing mm-hmm. heat, and he's running a, you know,
a military school.
A paramilitary school. Yeah.
Yeah. No, but it is interesting of the choice of failsafes being a gun, mm-hmm. right? And like, why make that choice? Because right. one could imagine that Charles has access to all kinds of wondrous technologies that it would facilitate what he's trying to do with a gun, perhaps easier and faster, right? So it's a very
human solution.
Right. It's an interesting like choice to pick at as to why that particular choice.
Right. And going on with the whole idea of the liberal hypocrisy thing that I think is interesting here is when Cassandra is talking to Donald in this next scene. And, you know, she talks about how, you know, behind the mask of liberal respectability with its safe opinions, we all hate the mutations. And she even says, you know, she's like, I know what you dream of. You dream of keeping women and children as slaves.
And Cassandra Nova's, the way that she speaks is I'm struggling to articulate it as well as she would. Her grasp on, she's so articulate, mm-hmm. verbose, so quick with her comebacks and explanations. It's almost like she's speaking to Trask on a higher level. And I think just her language and in comparison with his shows how far evolved she is from him, and the tone as well. She's very condescending and patient until the point that she doesn't need to be patient anymore. Mm-hmm. But I think that was another really good example of how Morrison is pushing the theme of evolution to its like absolute point, just pushing it as far as he could.
I think going along with that is every time I read this issue, what always jumps out at me is Cassandra's very first line at the beginning of this issue when she says, you know, they're not human, they're dirty, stinking mutants or something.
Yeah.
Like mm-hmm. that is, it doesn't feel like something she would say normally, but what you just said puts it in perfect context, right? She's telling this stuff because she knows she's speaking to Trask and she's kind of like giving him permission to go further.
And we don't normally see this with villains, or perhaps we don't have writers who are as astute or as in-depth as Morrison is. But, you know, normally they just say, I am genetically superior. But she doesn't have to say that. She's showing it just by the way she talks.
And I'm not sure if refreshing is the right word, but like I feel like other ex-villains before Cassandra sort of always couch their motivations behind like some kind of ideological veneer, like, you know, mutants are a threat, or we need to protect ourselves from those evil mutants. We're not evil, we're just, it's self-defense, right? But not Miss Nova. No, I mean, she just cuts to the quick of like, well, these are not people, actually. They're vermin to be exterminated. Like there's no need for all this hand-wringing. There's no need for all of this ideological justifications, right? Because we're talking about.
Yeah, and we'll be able to touch on that more when we get to the next issue. But mm-hmm. It's that whole idea of like, she's a predator, right? Mm-hmm. That's what she does. Mutants are her prey. And it's that kind of thing where it's like, you know, the lion doesn't have to rationalize killing the gazelle, right? It's just that's what the lion does.
I saw it as maybe she was going along with the first issue with that imagery of the Neanderthal and Homo sapiens fighting, and that she was looking at it. This is her evolutionary role, is right. to wipe out the ones that are beneath her so that she can then take over. And it's almost what the traditional bad guys were saying about humans previously. And it was nice to sort of see that flip a little bit.
And I love this page here when she's killing Trask, like the her hand going through him, and like going back to, you know, what you were saying about the about it being so visceral, like her hand going up through his head like that. It's just
With that knee, with the kneecap getting blown off, and then this hand shot, both of those images, they are really visceral, and it's almost like using his face like a glove. There's no blood, but it's still cringy.
Oh yeah! In fact, I think it's even cringier without the blood, because it feels so unnatural.
Yeah, like you're not exactly sure how that has happened. I mean, we know it's bad, right?
Right.
But but the mechanics of it is very strange and unknown to us. Mm-hmm.
And here we have some other little notes here, and I love all this. I didn't realize this until I was reading this again last night. Was that it reminds me of that scene in Watchmen when, you know,
I was thinking that too.
They confront Ozymandias and they said, you know, when were you planning on doing this? He's like, I did 10 minutes ago.
Yep.
And that's what's happening here in the background, right? This idea, like, you know, you know, sources in Cape Town, South Africa, which Genosha is off the coast of South Africa. Mm-hmm. And plus, you know, it was the whole point of Genosha was it was an allegory for apartheid. Mm-hmm. So we have all this happening in the background, and this is another thing too. Like I was always wondering before, and I never really put two and two together until last night, was her injecting herself here, right? That it never, I was always, I'd never really connected the dots until last night. And then I remembered, you know, jumping ahead a little bit, when she booby traps Xavier, her old body, when she puts Xavier's mind in it, right? And so it's like got Alzheimer's and all these other things that are corrupting it, plus the nano sentinels and all that. And that's what she's injecting herself with. She's booby trapping her body right here in this scene.
I thought she was injecting herself with the DNA, right?
That's what I thought at first too, but now that I'm thinking back over it, and when I was reading it last night, the whole thing about his body being the body being booby trapped and Xavier being like trapped in this dying body, and then how the nano sentinels get there. So I think this was like a precursor to that, and this is where she prepares for that.
I think she may have another mechanism as far as like getting Trask's DNA, because she doesn't seem to have enough time between the finger glove moment and the injection moment. But well, she's super smart, so it's a possibility,
right? And what do you guys think of this scene where they have Wolverine and Cyclops confronting her?
The main thing that I took away from the scene is I remember thinking, like, not really fully understanding what the go is with Cyclops's contact lenses. So he puts them in to shoot Ugly John, and then takes them out. So there's two sort of separate things to explore there from my point of view, and that is that Ugly John is you know about to die, and Wolverine says to Cyclops, "Oh, you have to put him out of his misery." Normally, that would be Wolverine's role. Not Cyclops. And Cyclops does it in a very cool, calm, matter of the fact way. And that was new for Cyclops. But this shows his growth. Straight away, we see that he's not the Boy Scout anymore. He's changed. He's a man now. And I saw that as almost like Wolverine showing us that Cyclops is a man. Wolverine doesn't have to second guess.
Mm-hmm.
I think previously he would have said to Cyclops, here, come and hold Cassandra while I go and put out Ugly John. Doesn't have to do that anymore. Cyclops grown up. And I didn't understand why he needed to take the contacts out in order to threaten Cassandra.
So the way I see it is, if you look at the panel right before the close-up on him talking to Ugly John, his hand is reaching up for his eyes. So I feel like he does have to take the lenses out to use his powers. And the lenses are just there, you know, an emergency thing to put in his eyes so that he can see when his visor is broken. But then he has to take them out actually to use his powers.
Okay.
Like, at least that's the way I saw it.
I was thinking after the reread that maybe it was that the visor, having a gap between his eyes and the visor allows him to shoot. And when the contact lenses are right in, there's no gap for the laser to come out, which I thought was a bit weird. But this is the first and only time it's ever touched upon that he wears contacts. It's never mentioned ever again.
Right. I think it's just because it's such an impractical thing. Because anyone who's worn contact can tell you that they're not really convenient, right? They're a pain in the ass.
And
how the fuck do you put them in without laser shooting everywhere?
Yeah.
I mean, he would go through a lot of mirrors at the very least, not to mention bodily injury to his face. But
I think his body is actually immune to his own powers.
That's right. That's right. Well, I just mean the glass shards that would shatter upon impact. I thought when I first read, like, what an interesting development for Scott, because like Oscar said, I think like before all the stuff that happened, and I think it's interesting that Morrison seems to be pulling at all of that search for Cyclops stuff that happened before. Like, this is so uncharacteristic for Scott, right? From what we've seen of him before. So it was both interesting and exciting that Morrison was taking him in this very on Boy Scout direction.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like his line too about, I know there's something more than just this world. Like, he's not saying that. He knows that for a fact.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's been there. So I think that was another really good thing here. But yeah, the contact lenses, I remember at the time thinking, oh, this is so cool. That makes so much sense. And then later thinking, wait a minute, that actually doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, I mean, like, maybe there's a chamber in the mansion and then Scott, and it's like specially designed for like contact lens application. That's how I'm making that work.
I do love this panel too, of just like how quietly has Wolverine's claws only partially coming out. I just love that idea. Like, you know, like his, like pulling back the trigger on a gun.
I agree.
I also like how quietly draws tech. I mean, not just here, but like whenever I just like the, and I mean, I don't know how fast of a draftsman he is, but there's just so much detail and line work involved.
Well, I think the fact that he had so many,
I appreciate.
They had so many fill-in artists during this run show, right? That he's not really that fast at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, that was one of the things that I remember people were always complaining back then on the message boards about how late this title was. But whenever we got art like this, I did not care because it's
worth the wait.
Yeah, it was
worth the wait.
And like, even here, this scene when Cyclops comes in again, credit to the colorist as well, but just like the way the smoke is blowing, it feels like, you know, you get that sense of momentum. And then the colorist putting the crimson tint in the cloud is also another good way to show that it's Cyclops' powers. Mm-hmm. Plus, again, with the overlay of everything in red when he kills Ugly John.
I've just realized that red panel is the only one that's red when they're not in the X-Wing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad we're up to this Genosha scene, the actual attack scene, because that's one of my favorite from here now. It's crazy to have such a macabre scene be one of your favorite, but I just think it's so incredible.
Yeah.
It's dynamic. I really love this notion of the giant bugs smashing little people, mm-hmm. which is terrible for the people, but the perverseness of it pushes all my right buttons.
It's the reversal of us squashing cockroaches as well. Yeah, right?
Yes.
Well, also too, when you think about, because cockroaches have existed long before humans have. So, mm-hmm. so there's that whole aspect of it too. Like that whole idea of like cockroaches have, you know, predate humans and they'll be alive long after we're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of taking it to the sci-fi level with this giant robot cockroach here. And I love Emma's introduction here, right? Again, we get everything we need to know about her in just this, you know, this one page, right? You look at her and, you know, she's sexy. She doesn't give a shit that she's, you know, wearing basically a bra and a jacket as a teacher. And just like her biting wit and her sarcasm right in this opening scene when she says, "We shall not be singing the words to Genosha, Genosha, Promised Island, Mutant Utopia," with your usual tuneless gusto.
I love it. I also love the gold star for the first one who finds mm-hmm. out the terrible truth about Tom and Cole.
Yes.
Yeah. And that I wondered when I was rereading that, whether people would get that pop culture reference, because it's probably a bit dated now. Mm-hmm. That people don't think of Tom and Nicole Cruz, like, you know, Tom Cruise
as
and Nicole
married
together yeah. anymore. Yeah. But when they did break up, it was especially in Australia, Nicole Kidman is like our favorite daughter, almost like royalty.
Mm-hmm.
And when her and Tom Cruise broke up, it was on the front page of every newspaper, every magazine, every internet article. It was everywhere, and everyone wanted to know what happened because we all saw them as this wonderful couple that was like the perfect marriage.
Right.
And we still don't know. We still don't know the answer to that, mm-hmm. that mystery.
I love the notion that there is indeed a national anthem mm-hmm. called Genosha, Denosha, Promise Island, Mutant Utopia.
Well, the thing I love about that scene is I'm not sure if Emma's joking about that or not.
Or if is it real? Like,
yeah.
It's also interesting how, and we'll talk about this more in the next issue, I'm sure, mm-hmm. Or the next episode, but just in these few panels, like Morrison establishes sort of like this very different take on Emma. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure how best to describe it, but she seems more relaxed. Like she seems more, I don't know. Like I think it's still consistent with what we saw of her in Generation X, but Morrison sort of reframes her in just a more, she seems more relaxed, more fun, if that makes sense.
Well, because it picks up from what's happened, because we saw what happened the last times she had students, like she had the Hellions and then they died. And then she was really overprotective of the Generation X kids, so much so mm-hmm. that they eventually, you know, got frustrated with her and, mm-hmm. you know, basically all just left. And so now it feels like that's kind of a reaction to mm-hmm. what had happened before. And so that's why she's got this more relaxed state.
I found one thing I didn't pick up on. I'm finding all these things that I didn't pick up on before. The scene where the kids are sitting in the classroom and she's telling them, you know, don't worry about singing the national anthem. Mm. The computers are floating.
Mm-hmm.
They're not connected to the chair.
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I didn't even pick up on that.
So it's a good little, it's a mutant university. Mm-hmm. It's a mutant school rather than like a normal thing. I love that. I wish I'd seen that the first time.
Which also but makes
that
me
image
wonder
of them all being blown away into pieces. That was reminiscent of the kneecapping mm-hmm. of the face being pushed, the hand being pushed through the face. You know, you see limbs flying, and it's all just very.
I mean,
sudden.
Yeah, that's why I zoomed mm-hmm. in on here because I wanted to make sure what I was seeing. But you see this, you know, this piece of the wall or whatever going through someone's leg,
mm-hmm.
and it is like just that visceral thing that you were talking about. Sorry, Pat, you were going to say something?
I was, now that Oscar mentioned that, I had this notion that like, are there even computers? Maybe this is just a psychic manifestation, but you do indeed see them get blown away in the next panel. So I think they were there and floating, which is pretty cool.
And this is another nod to what had happened before Morrison's run back in Eve of Destruction, right? Because Magneto's in a wheelchair here. Mm-hmm. And that's after, because at the end of Eve of Destruction, you know, Wolverine stabbed him in the back.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that's, and which was kind of interesting because I remember back when this came out, because I was reading these comics in real time, and everybody thought that Wolverine had actually killed Magneto at the end of that story arc, and because it wasn't really clear. And then we get to this and we're like, oh, wait, Magneto's not dead. Wait, why did he bring Magneto back when he was already pretty much dead in that issue anyway? So it was kind of a...
How did Wolverine attack Magneto in that Eve of Destruction? Did he like stabbed him through the chest or something, right?
I can't remember if it was through the chest or through the back, but it was something like that.
Stabbing was involved, though I don't recall the exact location.
It was in the torso area somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere.
It's crazy that you can get stabbed through the torso and it's, you know, you can't assume that they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
Yay for comics.
Well, the famous X-Men line, right? You know, I got better.
Mm-hmm.
Which I do kind of love that Hickman, you know, just to get on a bit of a tangent, how Hickman kind of flipped that on his head. Like, we know the X-Men always come back, so let's just make it part of the story now.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know whether I'm loving that or hating that. I'm loving that we're seeing some old deep cuts come back, like Sync.
Yes,
I'm still struggling to actually say Sync instead of Cinch, because I've always read it as Cinch.
Yeah,
I've always thought it's so weird. I think if it's Sync, why do you have the H there? But anyway, so I'm enjoying
same reason why Havoc is spelled with a K instead of a C.
It's frustrating. But
Sync
now
isn't, I feel like Sync isn't so much. I mean, you want deep cut. There's Peepers is back, and I'm like, Peepers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Sync's been dead for 20 years. Peepers is a very unknown. He was unknown to me. I didn't even know who he was. But they had a recent issue of where the Hellfire Club, where Lourdes comes back, and she was only in one issue. Mm-hmm. Something like 30 years ago. So it's cool to be able to explore some of those things and put fresh perspective on them. And it also just takes away the need for ridiculous reasons of retconning them back to life, right? Yeah. There's no one hiding in the bottom of the ocean in a telekinetic bubble. Can we talk a little bit about this this image of the Sentinel fist plane smashing into the tower and then crashing down in Magda Square, that looks a bit like Times Square in New York. And then the island being fumigated by a cockroach, because it does look like a fumigation, right?
Yeah. Well, also what you mentioned about the scale, like just like how, especially when you look back, because this is a great piece, because you look back at the previous page or previous few pages and you see all of Genosha right there, right? You see, so you see, get a sense of the scale here, right? Because there's the city, there's, you see this, it's this cluster thing here. And then you see this Sentinel and he takes over like almost the entire island himself. So it's a really good job of showing that scale.
I think as well, with the last page, is really well done in that the Sentinel is fumigating the island. And then the same way we saw the movement earlier on in the issue with the plane falling through the page, the numbers of the population as they're falling, as your eye is going from the top to the bottom of the page, the numbers are falling too, which gives it a sense of movement, even though it's just numbers.
What did you guys remember feeling when you got to the end of this issue back when you first read it? Because for me, I remember being like, you know, it's one, because, you know, they said, oh, well, you know, she's sending Sentinels out and they're going to kill mutants. That's standard. But then you get to this and it's like, well, wait, look at how big those numbers are. And I got a sense that this felt different from all the other kind of like Sentinel massacres we'd seen in the past.
Like that, I remember feeling this sort of repeated sense of disbelief of like, how did this get through editorial? Like they're doing this, like they're really doing it. Which is amazing to me. Like where would they go next? Like if this was greenlighted, what's coming next for us?
Right.
I remember just feeling shock, just pure shock. But it also reminded me of why I fell in love with the X-Men. And that was when I watched the animated series and Morph died. Mm-hmm. And it was like, wow, it's not... there are consequences to everything. And this was, I felt the same way I feel when I open up my computer and I read about a terrorist attack. And that is basically what Cassandra Nova did. It was a big terrorist attack on Genosha. I did feel a similar way, and maybe this is a little bit off tangent a little bit, but I did feel a similar way when I read the Legacy Virus issue a little bit earlier where Colossus died, and it just sort of came from nowhere. It was a shock. It felt real, it felt impactful, and it felt long lasting.
Yeah, Lobdell had a lot of issues with some of the storytelling, but some of those character stuff he did was really good. Like, I'm reminded that Colossus issue was amazing, and that issue when Illyana died as well, like that was that was like heartbreaking.
Definitely.
I'm also just now realizing that I think Charles is aware of the count, right? He is seeing that information and he's feeling all these things as the numbers keep going down.
Oh yeah, because like, there's this
and how devastating, how like this, I can't even imagine the scale of it, right? Because for us it's just numbers, but for him he's like jacked in to these people as they're dying.
Right, exactly. That's what I was going to say. He's connected to every single mutant mind on Genosha at this moment. Mm-hmm. And just one by one, he's feeling each of them die. And this sense, and I love this image of him like with the Cerebra Chamber, and he's overlooking this giant head overlooking Genosha, and this feeling of helplessness. Mm-hmm. Right,
like watching the tragedy unfold the same way we all watch tragedies unfold, right? Unless you're actually there in the moment, if you're unfortunate enough to watch a plane crash or a bombing or a terrorist incident, we all see it through media, through the news, through our laptops, through the screen, and that's the way the X-Men are watching it, and that's the way the X-Men should be watching it, right? They should be learning about it the same time that everyone else does, unless they're actually there in the moment.
Right,
and with this kind of attack, you're not going to be there at the moment.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So that's the end of issue 115. Any final comments you guys wanted to say about this issue?
The thing I would say is that when I read the first issue of this run, I was shocked by the I was like, wow, things are different, and this issue really hammered it home. This is where it was like, no, shit's about to go down. This is not the X-Men you knew before.
Pat, how about you?
I think it's a good middle of the arc installment. There's a real sense of escalation. So in the last installment, Morrison sort of establishes some of the pieces, and here he starts playing with them and then really ups the scale in a very unexpected way. So I think it does what a middle part of a story should do, which is build on what came before and then serve up a really undeniably compelling cliffhanger, right? That makes you come back, come back for the next.
Yeah, time. For me, I remember reading this issue and thinking that, you know, the first issue was good, 114 was good, but it in some ways it did just kind of feel like, you didn't really feel how much things had changed until you got to the end of this issue, at least back, that's my memory of it. And because you guys always remember the joke about the X-Men comics all throughout the 90s. You had this issue covered, like nothing will ever be the same again. And then, you know, 6 months later, everything is the same again.
But this one made it feel like that was actually true, that it delivered what it said on the tin.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This felt different. And I mean, ballsy for Morrison to do this, and ballsy for Quesada to let it go forward. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, this really felt like this felt like a different scale of disaster compared to what we've seen before. Okay, so that does it for this episode. Do you guys have anything you want to plug, anything you want to mention before we close up here?
I'll just plug my Twitter feed, my Twitter handle, which is ODAT220. Which was my university login. It's such a shit Twitter handle, but it's one I'll always remember now. So ODAT220, you can have a look at it to see my ramblings on politics and comic books and anything else that tickles my fancy.
Okay. Pat, how about you?
You guys can check out my Tumblr, which is actually called Perfect Fabergé Killing Machine, which will come up in our next episode.
I love that.
I just usually post about comic stuff and other things. And I also, again, would like to mention my other podcast, Kirkcohen Exports, which I'm working on at the same time I'm working on this one. And I think the releases should be simultaneous with this podcast. So be on the lookout for that.
Nice. And for me, I've got my books are at percivalconstantine.com. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's P-E-R Constantine, and on Instagram, PerryC812. I post up a lot of artwork and stuff I do on Instagram. The House of X group, they've got this Fan Art Fridays they're doing now. So last one was Jubilee. So I posted up a Jubilee picture I did up there the other day. And then this podcast, our Twitter handle and our Instagram feed is Morrison X Pod at both of those, and our website is eforevolution.transistor.fm. And my daughter's getting antsy over here.
She's like, "Hello, Dad, it's me."
Yeah.
I want to plug something.
And then the other thing is our email address. If you want to drop us a line, eforevolutionpodcast@gmail.com. Feel free to give us a review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen to your podcasts. And that does it for us. And we will be back next episode to talk about New X-Men number 116, the conclusion to E is for Extinction. E for Evolution, examining Grant Morrison's X-Men, is produced by Percival Constantine with theme music by Aaron Kenny. Audio of Grant Morrison and Stan Lee was recorded at San Diego Comic-Con 2008 and provided by bravogabo.livejournal.com. You can find E for Evolution on Twitter and Instagram at MorrisonXPod and on the web at eforevolution.transistor.fm. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email address is eforevolutionpodcast@gmail.com. Support the show by leaving us a review at Apple Podcasts, which helps us reach more listeners. Special thanks to the members of the House of X Facebook group for their encouragement in getting this show started.